good morning. Welcome to Lakeview. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever been to court? Maybe don't answer that out loud. Could be a sensitive conversation. Now, when I was a young man, I was just at a Bible college, and I was hired as a youth pastor in a town called Hepburn, Saskatchewan. Yes, great town. And I was driving from Saskatoon. I was visiting somebody in the hospital. This is very pastoral, very holy moment. And I was going back home to Hepburn, and I was in this, what I kind of assumed at 23, this gray area. It was a single-lane highway at that time. And if you go somewhere between, you know, up to 110, right? It's a 100-kilometer speed limit. But if you go up to 110, you should be okay, right? Like, that's kind of the gray area. I think we all understand that. That's agreed upon gray area of legal system. So I was in there, I thought, and then I saw the red and blue lights behind me. This is going to be confessional time here. And pulled over, and the police officer came to me and talked very nicely and kindly and explained where I was wrong and wrote me a ticket. And I remember being so frustrated and dejected by this. And part of it was because I was 23. I'd been just, like, I got married young. I was married a couple of years. We got a place in Hepburn, and we really didn't have any money. So a ticket was like a big deal. Like, this was a big deal. I was just so frustrated about it. And if I'm honest, frustrated with the police officer too. I'm like, come on. I was like, couldn't you just like give me a warning? I was just visiting somebody in the hospital. I was doing a good thing. He didn't see it that way. He was a man of law. It was good. So anyways, I got home and I felt guilty about it and I was frustrated about it and I was kind of like ruminating on it. And one of my friends said, you know, you can just go to court and like, you're guilty, but you can go to court and you can just explain your situation, throw yourself at the mercy of the court, and maybe the judge will have mercy on you and like, maybe they'll reduce the ticket. Like, and the friend said, yeah, I've done that before and I got my ticket reduced. And I thought, well, that's a good idea, except I've never been to court. And even just thinking about going to court, I got all really nervous and like anxious inside. And I thought, what if I go to court and there's people there and they're going to assume I'm there for like really nefarious, like bad things. And they're going to like have these assumptions, like there's this youth pastor and he's in court and like what's going on. And I had all these worries of like accusations and assumptions that are going to happen to me if I go to this court. And we lived in Hepburn and he said, well, like, I think for Hepburn, you go to Rosser in this other town. So, like, and they don't even have a courthouse. Like, it meets in Lyons Hall. And so, like, likely nobody will see you there. It's probably going to be quiet. Nobody will know. You'll be okay. And it's, like, it's not a big deal. People talk about their tickets all the time. I thought, okay, well, that sounds pretty good. Maybe I will do that. Maybe I'll go to this Lyons Hall. And so I looked it up. I figured out the time. I looked at my ticket when I could go. And sure enough, it was a roster at this Lyons Hall. And so I made the plan to do that. And I was, like, just... I don't know. I was all really nervous about it and anxious about it and still thinking and I was like, wasn't sleeping well. And I thought, just pay this ticket. Why am I doing this? But I thought, okay, I'll go for the experience and nobody will see me there. So what I, don't get ahead of me. So I go to Rostern and I realize they don't have court like daily in Rostern or weekly. Like it's a thing that happens monthly or even bi-monthly. I don't know. Like, and so like, because it happens less regularly, like they wait for everything till they have a full caseload to bring a judge and all the people there. Didn't know any of this. What I also didn't know, because it doesn't happen a lot, it's also a time that school field trips go to court. So there I was, a Valley youth pastor with all the Valley youth watching me as I sit there and everything in me going, what have I done? What are they thinking? I'm a little bit old. There's no cell phones like readily available. The kids aren't texting their parents. I'm seeing Paul in court. But I'm like, what are the conversations at home going to look like? And this is weird. Why am I even doing this? Like, A, am I wasting everybody's time over this $100 ticket? And B, like, there's actually like real cases here. Like, what am I doing? So that was my court experience. It was unpleasant. And it was a time where this will connect with something eventually. But it was a time where I had to like feel all this, like, what will people think? What will people accuse me wrongly about for being here? Just hindsight of the story, my ticket did get reduced, so it was worth going. But anyways, so today we find ourselves in the home stretch of our series, The Movement, and as we travel through the book of Acts, seeing the early church grow, renewed by the Spirit of God, the church is multi-ethnic, diverse, new family, is sharing the way of Jesus with the known world, and it's growing and it's expanding and it's this beautiful thing that's happening. And one of the things we've noticed over our time is as the movement is growing, it's confronting and dismantling a variety of barriers. Now, it's not dismantling all of them, but it's at the very least confronting barriers that it's seeing in its way as people are joining this new family of faith. And some of the barriers are we talked about over the last few weeks is nationalism, like us and them barriers, like we're, you know, those people are not like us. And this movement is breaking that barrier, saying, no, like this new diverse family is not about erasing a different group, people group, but inviting them into it with all their gifts in this new family of Jesus. The barrier of language, even to be able to understand one another, understand where we come from, to be able to communicate to each other's hearts and spirits. Barrier of religious laws and expectations, especially in that time, right? Like there's this all these Jewish cultural covenants that they had with God. And like, what do we do with them? Are they still there? Are they broken? That was another barrier that the movement is confronting. And in just worldview, cultural things that are like, who are we? Is God present already in other parts of the world? And if he is, how has he been speaking to those communities? So these are some of the barriers the movement has been approaching and confronting and dismantling as we've been going all along. Now, what's interesting to me, as we look at these barriers, what I've noticed, and I'm sure you have noticed as well, is how deeply tied these barriers are to our identities, right? Our identities of nationalism, where I come from, who I am, matters to us. Our identity of our language even, like what is the language we use to communicate? What is the language of our heart? Our identity of our religious affiliation. Who am I in this world? What do I believe? How does the world work? The barriers of worldview is like my identity. How do I see the world? And how do I understand the world? And how do I find myself functioning? And who am I in this world? A lot of these barriers are really deeply tied to our identities. And when our understanding of our identity is challenged or confronted, or challenging conversations begin to happen, what we find in their journey, especially through the book of Acts, when people's identities are challenged, not only do these barriers come up, they come up because fears rise up in us. Fears rise up around our identities. What do you mean there's something different than the way I always thought it would be? And so when our identities are challenged, these fears rise up, and we begin to try to wrestle with, like, well, where do I belong? What does that mean? Where's my home? If this is, like, how do I understand my identity in light of this story, in light of this movement? What do I do with who I am, my friends? And friends, fear drives people to take control. Fear drives us to gain power or regain power and to make sense of our situation and to make sense of our environment and say, okay, I'm being challenged by this. Fears rise up, so I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to take action. And typically and most often, this control and action comes in a way of domineering. Sometimes, and a lot of times, I should say, in the way of violence. To eliminate this fear in us, to make sense and draw nice lines to say, this is who I am, this is my identity, this is where I belong. Robert Wilson, a psychologist and speaker, puts it this way: the more fearful a person or peoples are, the more control over their environment they believe they need to feel safe. Keep that in the back of your mind. And this is kind of where we find ourselves in our series. Fears are arising. Control unleashes tools of violence to regain power. But before we just jump into our chapter today, which is chapters 22 to 24, it's probably important to give a little bit of context what I mean to this. So Apostle Paul, in our journey so far, what we've been seeing is going to the Jewish people first and then to the Gentiles. And we find that many actually are accepting this new movement. It actually makes sense with their identity. It actually makes sense with the things that they've been longing all along. The church is growing. The family begins, this new, diverse, multi-ethnic family begins to grow. But we also see that Paul finds opposition because fears are rising up from both Jewish people and Gentiles. Now, for the Jewish people who oppose, they specifically accuse Paul of betraying them. He's breaking the laws of God. He's breaking the Torah, the Mosaic laws, and the covenants given to the Jewish people. And so because of that, he's a traitor to his own people. His identity is challenged. You're a traitor to your own people, Paul, by doing this. Now, for the Gentile people who oppose Paul, they accuse him of being subversive to the way and life of Rome. So they accuse him of being a dangerous social revolutionary who's trying to topple Caesar by talking about this new king, Jesus. And therefore, he's trying to destroy their social and religious norms. And so for the Gentiles, he's a traitor to the state. These are the accusations leveled against Paul. You're a traitor to your own people, and you're a traitor to the Gentiles. You're a social revolutionary. We don't fully understand what you're doing. And so the movement is challenging challenging people to think of their identities and who they truly are. And it's causing an upheaval wherever Paul is going with his companions. There's acceptance of the way, for sure. It's growing. And there's large confusion, accusations, and mobs and riots are beginning to rise up because fear of betrayal is rising in both communities. There's fear going around. What is this guy really talking about? Last week he said, to quote him, what is he babbling about, they said. So Paul, in where we find him today, he goes back to Jerusalem. This is his final missionary journey. He makes his way back, and all his companions are saying, don't go. Don't go, Paul. There's stuff going on. All this fear is rising up. People are frustrated with you. They know you. There's trouble awaiting you. Please don't go. But Paul is determined. And he returns, and as predicted, he gets attacked by the Jewish people who think he's betrayed Israel, his own people. He's a traitor of the worst kind. And because of the attacks on Paul, there's a commotion and there's a mob that's forming. And the Roman soldiers see the mob and they're like, okay, they're all about order. We got to prevent this. So they step in and they arrest Paul because they think he's this rebel who's causing this. And they take him away. And this is where we find ourselves in our chapter today. Now, just again, before we just jump in, these chapters are filled with court cases, arguments, accusations, defensive responses, lawyers, and seemingly, if I'm honest, can seem kind of tedious when we read. It feels like this movement is gaining the ground and there's all this awesome God stuff. The Spirit is moving. People are changing. And we get to these chapters and it's kind of like all this court drama. And it feels like the movement almost takes a pause. And it's like, why is this here? Like, why can't we just get through these logistics right to Paul going to Rome, teaching about Jesus to Caesar? Like, let's get to that. Like, why do we have to stay in this little drama here? But what I want us to notice today is that there's actually a really important movement that happens in this court drama. So let's find out and read. As Paul speaks, right before he's arrested, he shows up and this Jewish mob confronts him and he says this. Brothers and fathers, now he uses his family language. Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense. Now when they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet. So he uses a family language, and he speaks their language. So they quiet down. Then Paul said, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city, in Jerusalem. I studied under Gamaliel and was thoroughly trained in the law of our ancestors. I was just as zealous for God as any of you are today. I persecuted the followers of this way to their death, arresting both men and women and throwing them into prison. As the high priest and all the council can themselves testify, I even obtained letters from them to their associates in Damascus and went there to bring these people as prisoners to Jerusalem to be punished. Paul roots himself in his people. I am you. In the face of accusations and betrayal and being a traitor to his own people, he says, I am you. I'm going to speak your language. I'm going to speak in Aramaic. And they listen. And what he shares, these local details really matter. Yes, Tarsus is where he was born, but he was raised in Jerusalem. They know him. In the mob are probably likely people he studied with, possibly even relatives. And like them, he was zealous for God. He was the mob. He was the arm that reached out and hurt those that opposed the law. This was his home. His identity is deeply rooted here. This was who he was. He too sought power and control when fears of betrayal rose up. Paul is deeply Jewish, deeply Orthodox, deeply respect, comes from a deeply respected birth, deeply respected background, training, and zeal. And all of it led him straight into the path of Jesus. And now Jesus had led him to face this mob of people. Paul's case and life, his defense, his argument, all rest on the encounter with Jesus. As we continue reading, Paul says, "And then the Lord said to me, 'Go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles.'" The crowd listened to Paul until he said this. Then they raised their voices and shouted, "Rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live." As they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust in the air, the commander ordered that Paul be taken into the barracks. He directed that he be flogged and interrogated in order to find out why the people were shouting at him like this. And as they stretched him out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there, "Is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty?" So, a little bit about this passage. It was actually the mention of Gentiles which inflamed this mob. Paul says, "I'm you, I was with you, you know me, I've trained in this." And when he mentions the Gentiles, the mob riots. It was not that they objected to the preaching of Gentiles, but what they objected to was that Paul is teaching that they can have all the privileges they have without accepting all the laws, without circumcision, without abstaining from certain foods. If Paul had preached all the restricting demands of Judaism to the Gentiles, all would have been well. So we need to really notice why they're upset. It was because he preached the grace of Jesus to all people that they were enraged. Showing their disapproval in the traditional way, they shouted and waved garments and threw dust in the air. This was a way of to protest. And it's interesting here that the Roman commander does not actually understand the language. It seems to me that he doesn't understand Aramaic and doesn't know what's happening here. But what he does understand is that the riot is forming and he can't have this. So he pulls Paul out to flog him. Now, I just want us to note here, too, that this is not a punishment. And I say this for those of you that have been reading the text and kind of tracking along, or maybe you'll read this week, and it kind of could seem through these court cases that Romans kind of come out like really just and fair, and they have this legal system, and it's the Jewish people that are really violent. But that's not what Luke is actually drawing out here. This is why this detail is so important. This is not a punishment. They're literally taking Paul to just beat him, to get information out of him. They're like, "Well, something's happening here. We're not sure what it is. So why don't we just whip him?" Luke is reminding us how the Roman state, how violent they really are. So Paul's not being punished here. What we see here is the tool of oppressive state of power structures must always use violence. The commander is not sure what's going on. So, well, let's just get to the bottom of it. We'll just beat him. As if there's no other way. As if there's no other imagination but violence. And so barriers rise up, and the tools of violence is used to control by both Jewish leaders and the Roman leaders. What we're witnessing so far in Acts is that whenever the way of Jesus shows up, there's a violent opposition. Whenever the way of Jesus show up, there's a violent opposition. The structures of this religious control that Paul has encountered and the power structures of the state lean into and rely on the tool of violence to bend him to their will. So Paul speaks up. He speaks up to the Jewish mob to tell them, "I'm you. I'm your family. And he speaks up to the Roman commander and says, I'm a Roman citizen. I'm you. Paul locates his identity in his Jewish Roman citizenship. He's uniquely positioned to actually speak to both of them and to witness the way of Jesus to both. He is both. But because of Jesus, he's also neither. He no longer finds his home in either his Jewishness or his Roman citizenship. He's actually in exile. He is them, but he sees the fulfillment of both. He's in the world, but not of the world. So the Roman commander is determined to figure out what's going on, and so he brings Paul before the Sanhedrin in order to get to the bottom of the trouble. Now, Paul faces Sanhedrin in these next chapters, which is like a supreme council, a tribunal of the Jewish people, headed by the high priest. This is a place where all the religious, civil, and criminal cases are decided for the Jewish people. And the Romans are kind of working with the Jewish crowd. They don't want riots. They don't want a revolution. So they're working amongst the people with them. So they take him to the Sanhedrin. They're like, okay, present your case. And Paul is tried by his people with the help of the Roman state, a man falsely accused. And we know he's innocent. Like, by the way, like, this is clear. Like, the author Luke is writing in these chapters, and he makes it clear that both accusations of him being a traitor to the state or the traitor to his people, that he's actually innocent of that. He's not stirring up people into revolts against Caesar, and he's not telling people you're not Jewish anymore. He's actually fulfilling something greater and bigger that's happening here. He's in the world, but not of the world. He's innocent from both sides of accusations. He's them. He's not betraying them. But he's also not at home in them. We find ourselves seeing Paul before courts of his own people and then later before the Roman governor. And he keeps repeating his defense and his encounter with Jesus to both courts. And he keeps going about Jesus and his encounter over and over and over. Because of this, there's even an assassination plot that gets thwarted. The tools of violence keep rising up. Paul is defending himself. Romans have no idea what to do with this. The Jewish people want him dead. So why does this all matter to us? Well, let's unpack a little bit of what we've learned today. First, we should note that the reason why Paul would go to this dangerous place, even though his companions, even though his friends are all pleading for him not to go, there was a drought in Jerusalem, and so Paul actually has collected all this money to help the church in Jerusalem, but he doesn't have to go. They could send somebody else, somebody less notorious. They can help the church through somebody else. Why does Paul want to go? What's going on here? Well, for Paul, he goes because this is a very personal journey in a very significant way that not only confirms his identity, but confirms his faith. And Luke is reminding us in this, in Paul's court's defense. It's personal for Paul and deeply significant. After all, for Paul, Jerusalem is where it all started. Paul was raised, trained, and promoted in his faith in Jerusalem. Paul was also zealous for God, as we just talked about. After all, he participated in the murder of Jesus' followers. He was an enemy to Christians. He too, at one point, saw them as the enemy and traitors and infiltrators to the one true faith. But now, after encountering Jesus, he gets to return and serve those he persecuted. It is deeply personal for Paul. His identity and who he was and what his faith has always taught him has been revealed and fulfilled in Christ, that his posture from a murderous accuser changes to a servant. It's personal because he's now also going to face some of his old colleagues, some friends, family, and insist that he's actually a loyal follower of Jesus, and it is their own tradition that has actually led him straight to Jesus. That this has always been the tradition, that this is where it was always leading. He's a witness of the Jesus way as a faithful Jewish person. This is personal for him.
The trajectory of the God story has always been leading to Christ. And the way of Jesus, Paul recognizes, the way of Jesus isn't safe. But it also transformed a murderous, zealous man into a servant. But that's not all. It's not just about because it's so personal for Paul. It's a big part of it. But there's actually a phenomenal and large parallel at play here. And Luke is carefully writing out for us not to miss it. We need to pay close attention that we should note that in Paul's passage, in his journey to Jerusalem, is strongly reminiscent of Jesus' final journey to Jerusalem and death. This is actually massive and important movement here. The journey mirrors the journey of Jesus. Luke is very careful writing this out. Willie James Jennings, in his commentary, puts it this way: who can bear the pain of being seen as a traitor? Who can walk the trail of the trial of betrayal? Luke brings us to this Jesus space found in the plight of Paul. Luke, the author of Acts, is careful here, laying out for us a parallel. Paul's life in the way of Jesus leads him to the life of Jesus. Can I say that again? Paul's life in the way of Jesus leads him to the life of Jesus. Paul's passage to Jerusalem mirrors Jesus. Paul is arrested and, like Jesus, is also made to face Sanhedrin. Jewish leaders begin to accuse Paul of starting a revolt against Rome, like they did with Jesus. And like the case before Pilate in Jesus, they can't really prove it. And Romans don't know what to do with it. Similarly, just like Jesus in the gospel, Paul does not really experience a trial as much as a hearing. But unlike Jesus, Paul seizes the initiative and disrupts the assembly by his direct behavior and speech. Now, Paul can do this precisely because Jesus has overcome death through the tool of violence, the cross, by defeating death and showing us the way home. Because of this victory, Luke is showing us that Paul can be bold in his witness, a boldness that refuses to use the tool of violence themselves or to bow down to it. Here's the thing about this movement we see in Paul. When you accept, when you step into the way of Jesus, when you become part of this new diverse, multi-ethnic family, you begin to align and become like Jesus. Your journey takes you into the journey of Jesus. The structures of power may persecute you, maybe, but they don't define you. No slander of identity, accusation of betrayal can stick, because your identity is in Christ Jesus alone. The movement is all about leading you in the way of Jesus to Jesus. And that way may be difficult at times. Your identity will be challenged. Your place in the world may be challenged. But like Paul, we learn that our truest identity, our truest home, has always been leading us to Christ. We are exiles seeking our true home. Now, what do I mean by exiles? Does it mean we deny our culture? Does it mean we deny our nationality? Does it mean we deny our worldviews, our home? Well, Paul didn't. He saw himself as a deeply Jewish, faithful man who is a Roman citizen. He didn't deny those things about himself. But his identity was more than that, much more. He said the fulfillment of them. And maybe to help us understand what I mean by that, maybe to help us understand what I mean by exiles and how to be an exile and still hold on to our to our Canadianism and to our Christianity or whatever our cultures, backgrounds are, maybe to help us with that, let's look at Prophet Jeremiah, who years before Jesus understood the way of God and spoke about exile. Exile, which included violence, subjugation, opposition, and oppression, as Jewish people found themselves in captivity in Babylon. And so Jeremiah said this while they're in exile. build houses, settle down, plant gardens and eat what they produce, marry and have sons and daughters, find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Jeremiah echoed to us the way of Jesus in exile. Being away from home, we are reminded that our true home is Jesus. This is what the movement, this is the, what the way is leading us to. Our truest home is Jesus. But our exiled lives consist of doing good wherever we are. To pray for, to contribute, to seek the peace and prosperity of the city. And no matter how we prosper, we are to never forget that our truest identity, our truest home is found in Christ, who has overcome the world. So in exile, we are invited to pray for the city, to seek its prosperity, to seek its peace. We're invited to be peacemakers, to plant gardens even in the deserts, to care even for our enemies. We are invited to seek the good of Saskatoon. Praying, our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done in Saskatoon as it is in heaven. The way of Jesus is not safe. But the way of Jesus leads us to the life of Jesus. Would you pray with me? Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. Amen. Amen.